Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Minda Zetlin is my guest today, and she's written a new book called Career Self-Care. So what does career self-care mean? Well, we've talked many times on the show. There are many, many, many books out there on self-care. We've also talked about career advice, and again, there are many, many books out there on the shelves about career advice. Career Self-Care is one of the few books I've seen that actually makes a connection between the two, between self-care and managing your career. There's scientific evidence to back this up, that the better you take care of yourself, the more you make sure to take true recreation time and enjoy your time off when you need it, the better it is for your career. And again, scientific evidence to back that up. So Minda says that she learned many things through the course of her extensive work on this subject, but she mostly learned that building the life and career you really want is more about changing your overall approach. It's about changing the way that you value yourself. And that's what we're talking about today. So let me tell you a little about my guest. Minda Zetlin is the author of several books, including The Geek Gap and the one we're talking about today, Career Self-Care. She writes the highly popular Laidback Leader column for Inc.com. Her articles and workshops offer research-backed advice to help people get the most out of their careers and their lives. And she lives right up here in Washington State. So again, the name of her book is Career Self-Care, Find Your Happiness, Success, and Fulfillment at Work. And here's my guest, Minda Zetlin. Minda Zetlin, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I know you're not from here, Minda, but you live in the Pacific Northwest now, and it's always great to have a local author join us. What made you move to the Northwest?
That is a long and complex story, but I can tell it. I can tell it quickly. So I grew up in New York City, and I moved up to Woodstock, New York, which is about 100 miles north of New York City, and isn't where the big festival happened, but nevertheless is often thought of in conjunction with it. And I lived there with my husband happily for 20-something years, and he always had a hankering to move someplace else. And his best friend, who was the best man at our wedding, moved from there to Lake Stevens, which is actually where I live, to connect with an old flame. They wound up getting married. We came out for the wedding. We fell in love with it, and so...
Love all around.
The very sad thing is that our friend, right as we were moving, was diagnosed with lung cancer, and he died a couple of years later. But we are happy here. We've made a lot of friends here, and we were able to be here for him, which was a blessing, too.
Yeah, very serendipitous. Sad, but serendipitous. So tell us how you got interested in writing and putting on workshops based on how to get the most from our work and our lives.
Well, so the writing is really a lifelong thing. I think I was, 12 or something, and I was an only child, so I spent a lot of time in my head, as I still do, and I had created this little cartoon storybook thing just for myself called The Joni Trio, and my mother came upon it, and she looked at it, and she said, "Oh, you're a writer," and I said, "I am." And I was, and I have kept writing ever since, one way or another. So it goes back a long, long way. About 10 years ago, I started writing this column for Inc., the website of Inc. magazine, Inc.com, called The Laidback Leader, which turned out to be pretty popular. I was writing a lot of columns, so I covered a lot of different subjects, and I noticed that readers really seemed to click on and respond to subjects around productivity and mindfulness at work and basically not making yourself miserable while having a great career. So I kind of veered in that direction, and it grew up into a book.
Yeah, well, a very successful career for you there. And the book is called Career Self-Care, Find Your Happiness, Success, and Fulfillment at Work. And I want to talk about this before we dive into my other questions, but because it's not what you would typically expect from a career book, which is, you know, how to put your resume together, how to kick butt in interviews, and, you know, assessing your strengths and your skills. It's really about looking a little deeper inside ourselves and getting some kind of authenticity with our work-life situation. So tell us in your own words how you describe it.
Well, actually, I love that description you just did. When you've written a book yourself, sometimes it's very hard to describe it. Usually my one-sentence description, because you know you have to have one if you're an author, is how to have a career you love and a happy life without making yourself miserable. But, I think so many of us, and particularly so many of us in the United States, and I think probably the UK also, are so career-oriented and so driven that we can focus on our careers to the exclusion of a lot of other stuff, including our own happiness and even health. And we live in a society that essentially rewards us for doing that, right? I mean, the richest mm-hmm. in the world right now is Elon Musk, who famously works all the time and, you know, never emerges from under his desk. So,
unless he's flying to space.
Right, unless he's flying to space or sending a car up to space, right? Yes, plans to travel to Mars, where I imagine he'll be just as much of a workaholic as he is on planet.
Yeah, really.
But I think for so many of us, when we get wrapped up in that, we don't see the bigger picture of our lives and our careers. And my book is really a call to do that and to see how actually taking care of yourself is a really important component of career success, for the simple reason that, you know, whoever you are, whatever your career, whatever your job, that job is being done by a human being. And everything will go better, including your performance on that job, if the human being is happy, healthy, and at ease.
Yeah. And of course, we're reaching epidemic levels of burnout across the globe, I think. I think America is still predominantly so work-focused because we don't have the kind of benefits that many other countries have around parental leave and things like that, and vacation. You know, Australia is quite famous for, you know, having so much vacation. Britain doesn't do too bad. And, you know, we're lucky if we get our 2 weeks. And people are so afraid often to take those 2 weeks, even though they've worked for them and they're entitled to them. It's part of their benefits package. But study after study has shown we do so much better for taking a break. So that's really where I want to begin today, Minda. I practice this for a long time. Do I do it every week? No, but I do it most weeks, where I take one full day off work, no email, no phone calls, unless it's a friend, nothing to do with work. And when I tell people that, they say it's just not possible, and I just don't believe that's true. So tell me your perspective on that.
Well, I actually have the same practice, except that you're a step ahead of me because I'm not sure that I could go an entire day without reading my email. My phone's in my hand at some point. I'd see the email, so it's like an umbilicus. I can't cut it off. But other than that, everything else, yes, I also strive to have one day a week with absolutely no work in it. And I really actually try and take the weekend mostly. I do wind up working a little bit most weekends, but I try to take the weekend, and I definitely try to take one day off. And, you know, I think the most successful people that you know, leaving aside Elon Musk, actually do set some boundaries like that around their time. I mean, even Steve Jobs was probably the most career-obsessed, work-obsessed person that ever lived, maybe. He would get home at 5:30 for dinner every night.
Oh, I did not know that about him.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he did that his whole life, but by the end of his life, by the time he had settled down and married and all, and yeah, he would do that. I actually had an epiphany around this because it was not always this way. There was a time when I really was working every day, 7 days a week, and I was increasingly miserable to be around. Mm-hmm. At one point, my husband said, you know, he actually said, you have to schedule some time every day to talk to me because you're not talking to me enough. So, you know, there was a time in my life when I wasn't following this practice at all.
Yeah. Well, I have a simple solution to the email on the phone thing. I just never set mine up. I deliberately did not set up my business account on my phone because I knew the temptation would be too great. But, you know, that's maybe not possible for everyone. I can see if you're a realtor, you need to have instant access. But I think most of us, you know, it can wait a few hours most of the time. So I want to talk about ways that we can give ourselves more space to breathe and the benefits of that, because they are many. So where do you tell people to begin if they're in this? And I've certainly been there many times myself, and, you know, I still struggle with it, even though I try really hard to take that one day off a week. There are times when that's just not possible because of the workflow, but, you know, mostly it's because we've taken on too much, got too much going on. So where do we begin? What do you tell people to look at in their life?
Wow, where do you begin? There's so many different places to begin. But I think actually the one day off a week is where I began. And that was a piece of advice I had gotten from a productivity expert. It's really great. It can really help you to do a tiny bit of research, because as soon as you do, you'll see study after study showing, for example, that if you work 40 hours a week, you'll actually get more done than if you try to work 60 hours a week, just because of the way productivity drops off, and mm-hmm. most of us in knowledge professions. I actually think, where would I tell people to start? I think a great place to start, this is going to sound a little bit odd perhaps, but a great place to start is to take a walk. Just go outside, ideally someplace where there are trees, if possible, but wherever you are, just go outside and spend 10 minutes outdoors, walking around, breathing something other than the air in your office, and paying attention to things that are around you, because that simple act of separating yourself from whatever is making you crazy about your job will give you a little bit of perspective. It doesn't take very long. I mean, I think everyone could fit a 10-minute walk into many of our work days, or at the beginning of the day or the end or something. You know, it's very hard to say there's no time to take a 10-minute walk. It'll be good for your health and your mental health as well. So I think that's one place I might suggest people start.
Yeah, definitely. And we talk about this on the show all the time, you know, the power of being outdoors, even if it is only for those 10 minutes, because you're in a different environment, the sensory input is different, it separates you from the computer. It's because I do feel chained to mine most of the time. And I'm always looking for ways where, how can I work outdoors? How can I take my work outdoors? You write about, there's a whole chapter on this, what if we showed up at work as ourselves? And this is something I'm interested in and have followed leaders on this and certain studies. It's hard to do because companies do pride themselves on having a culture. And if you don't fit into that culture, you're probably not going to fit into that company. And if you bend to fit that culture, you know, during the interview process and your probation period, whatever, at some point you're going to start feeling really unfulfilled because you're not being yourself. It's just not sustainable. So what do you mean we need to show up at as ourselves at work?
Well, it goes back to what I said before. The person doing the job is a human being, and we all need to kind of keep that in mind, even though, as you sort of implied, a lot of employers seem to really fight that notion, you know? I mean, you're not supposed to have, I mean, in the most extreme cases, you're not supposed to have a personal phone call. You're not supposed to have pictures of family at your desk. I mean, that's extreme. But you might have to wear a uniform, you know?
Right.
So, and even if there's not an official uniform, there might be an unspoken uniform. I once read an account of a man who was passed over for promotion at IBM because the tradition at IBM was that everyone, this was when it was, all the managers were male, I will say, all the managers wore the same color shirt as their immediate supervisor, as their leader. And if you didn't do that, it was a big faux pas of some sort. So, and he thought that was too restrictive, and so he quite deliberately wore a light blue shirt to some gathering or something where his supervisor always wore a white shirt, and sure enough, he got passed over for a promotion. And the newsletter I read this in, he was saying that with hindsight, he understood why it was the right decision to pass him over for promotion for doing that. So workplaces can really fight humanity and individuality. I think that's less true than it once was, especially with something else that I talk about in my book, the way the line between work and home is disappearing, particularly disappeared a lot during the pandemic. So showing up to work as yourself is going to be easier or harder depending on how much you're valued at work, how much you fit with the culture, because, as you say, some cultures are a good fit, some aren't. If culture is a really bad fit for you, maybe you should consider trying to fit someplace else. I'll just say. It can mean something as simple as putting up a poster of something you really care about. Perhaps not political in our very divided society, but other than that. It might be expressing an emotion. If something makes you really upset at work, being a little bit upfront about that sadness or even anger, again, you know, appropriately expressed. It might mean dressing as yourself. It might mean letting people know that, you know, you have a small child and you have to make some accommodations for that. All those things can be scary in the modern world. And all those things, though, will help you make a better whole out of your work life and your real life. And that's the really important thing to do.
Yeah, you write about this quite a bit. And you know, where we show up, we are expected to be professional, and we, you know, toe the line and don't show too much of ourselves at work. But the irony is, and this is, you talk about in the book, the only way you can create real connection is when other people get to know you and you get to know them. And I can remember being in a situation like that when I was a very young manager, and I ran into an issue with somebody who thought I was aloof because I was busy and I was running down the corridor all the time, you know, and I'd always say hi, but I didn't stop to gossip around the water cooler. And my boss said, it's because they don't know you. They don't know your sense of humor. And I'm like, well, I'm supposed to like stop at the water cooler every day and like share my humor with them. But I did make the effort and it did make a difference.
Yeah, it does. When I wrote the book, I started thinking about an interview I had done years earlier with a man who's both a style consultant and, you know, brought up this issue of being yourself at work to me. So this was, again, a few years ago. He's black, and he's gay, and he was in the financial industry, which is very straight-laced, and he was trying to figure out how he, as a gay black man in corporate America, could fit in. And so what he did was he went full camouflage. He, you know, wore the suits and was very buttoned down and very straight-laced. And he, at some point, got a review that said, you know, we like his work a lot, but we just don't know who he is. And so, which sort of harkens back to the experience you had. I think, to pull in a slightly related current topic, we find ourselves talking a lot about in the office versus remote work these days. And one of the advantages of in the office work, and it does have some, is this exact thing. We get to know each other as human beings. We're physically around each other. We share, you know, snacks, conversations, walks to the elevator and whatever. And those things are important. Relationships at work are hugely important.
Yeah. Yeah. And funnily enough, I was in the financial industry at the time, too. So I can relate
there
to
you
him. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. If you don't fit, you don't fit. But it's, you know, you do what you can to be successful. So we've seen people have been calling it the Great Resignation, you know, during and after the pandemic. And Gallup reframed that to the Great Discontent, which I think, you know, sums it up beautifully. And you talk about everyone has a day job and a dream job. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that. And it is a struggle for people because having gone through all of what everybody's gone through the last few years, you certainly want to be happy in what you're doing every day. And when people aren't, you know, we know what happens. They either disengage, which case they, you know, they're no good in the workplace really, or they become sick, or they just quit. So what are you finding when you're working with people out there?
I think the pandemic brought up a lot of questions for people about, you know, kind of what am I doing with my life, which is sort of a question that my book invites you to ponder because, you know, every day, every week, every month, or whatever is the time that you're working, but at some point you step back and think about your life as a whole and what you want to be doing with it. And I think that for a lot of people, the pandemic caused that. You know, now we're, you know, in a whole other kind of phase of history in terms of what's going on in the world. But when I talk about the day job and the dream job, yes, everybody has work that they love to do. Every job has components that are a drag to do. Even the President of the United States has to spend a fair amount of time doing stuff that he or she doesn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of every job. Now, if there's no part of your job that you enjoy and no part of your job that's what you want to do, you know, that's a good reason to try and make a change if you possibly can. But assuming that there are some parts of your job that you love, it's just, I think, really useful to kind of look at what those are and whether it's possible to do more of that and what the parts of your job are that you hate and whether it's possible to do more of that or less of that, rather.
Right.
And, you know, is some of that stuff that you could streamline, automate, delegate to someone else. You know, most of us are really bad at that last thing, but we all need to learn to be better at it. Or maybe just not do it all. There's, I think, a lot of things that we all do that if we really thought about them, we might think, you know, I don't necessarily need to spend time on this. So that's the day job versus dream job concept, is to find as much of your dream job as you can within the job that you have and minimize the day job part if you can do that.
Right. And, you know, if we want to be successful, we would set goals. And you talk in the book about how psychologists term something goal ambivalence, because people may have hopes for an outcome. They may have expectations about where they should be or want to be or expect to be. And yet, at the same time, they fear the outcome. So how do they work around that? Because those two things don't go together very well.
So setting goals, that's one of the things I do workshops about. I think it's a really helpful thing to do as kind of an exercise. But things that keep us from reaching our goals are many. But one of them is definitely fear. And to me, that's what often comes up in goal ambivalence. I think we're afraid of two things and sometimes both things at once. So if you're reaching for a goal, especially if it's a stretch goal or something that you've really wanted or something you've wanted for a long time, you reach for the goal and you think, if I really throw my best effort into this, if I really do my best and it doesn't happen for me, I'll be crushed. And I'm not sure I can manage that. I'm not sure I can handle those feelings. You know, it's a lot safer to think, oh, well, I haven't gotten there because I never really tried. Or, oh, well, I'll try tomorrow, you know, and tomorrow. And, of course, you know, sooner or later,
run out of tomorrows.
You never really gave it that try. The other thing that's frightening is, what if I do reach my goal? Because if it's a big goal, it's going to mean some big changes. And no matter how uncomfortable we are, no matter how frustrated or upset or depressed we are in our current roles and our current lives, change is always frightening.
Mm.
So that's just human nature. So, you know, that's where a lot of this stuff comes from. It is, interestingly, and I read a study about this recently, and I realized, oh, this is so true. It is, interestingly, where procrastination comes from. You know, I mean, most people, I would bet most people listening to this have procrastinated on something or other at some time or other, because we all have. Again, it's part of being human. And you think of procrastination, and, you know, you yell at yourself, and you think, oh, you're so lazy, oh, what's wrong with you, right? I mean, we think of procrastination as laziness. It's actually about fear. And as soon as I read that, I realized how true that was in my own life. And one example that came to mind immediately is that I went out and dug out, I spent 2 hours digging blackberries out of my yard. And I'm so glad I'm talking to people in Seattle, because you know what the Himalayan blackberries are like. Sometimes I'm talking to people in other parts of the country, and it's like, you can't imagine these blackberries that we have here. I spent 2 hours digging blackberries out of my yard instead of making a 5-minute phone call to schedule a mammogram appointment that I knew I needed.
Hmm.
So what do you think that was? Was that laziness or fear?
Yeah, that's definitely fear. Yeah, and I've done it myself many times. We've talked about procrastination a lot on this show. In fact, we talked about it, I think, 2 weeks ago with Kate Ekman, because it's a big thing, and people have to understand the psychology of it. We have to understand the psychology of it to really be able to work through it.
Right. And I think, you know, if you find yourself procrastinating, which you will, because, you know, and I will too, in spite of anything I've learned about it, because it just happens. That's the question to ask yourself, you know, not what's wrong with you, why are you so lazy, but what are you afraid of?
Mm. Yeah. I do remember scrubbing the kitchen floor once when I lived in San Diego on my hands and knees rather than go and study for my securities exam. Not necessarily because I was so afraid, but because I just found it not interesting. And I think I was afraid to admit that to myself, because that would have meant I was making a misstep in my career. So it boiled back to fear at some level.
It happened too. There was something about it, though, that you really wanted, too, right? So you had to figure out what it was that you wanted and what it was that you didn't want and where to find a different path.
That's true. That's very true. And it was freedom and independence. Yeah, very true. So you also say, don't be afraid of happiness. You write, don't be afraid of happiness. And on the surface, we might think, well, who the heck would be afraid of happiness? So talk to us about that.
Well, happiness is can be scary, because we always think, oh, that, you know, the other shoe is going to drop. But we also feel like happiness, particularly, and I think this happens even more in other cultures, but even in our own culture, if I'm happy, someone else is going to be unhappy, or I'm doing something wrong, or I'm being selfish, right? You know, making ourselves happy is selfish. I actually, you know, when you sign books, you have to, or you don't have to, but you often come up with a tagline to sign the book with. Mine on this book is make yourself happy, because I think that's so important.
Hmm.
We actually have, and I have to credit Gretchen Rubin and Robert Louis Stevenson for this, but we actually have not just the right to be happy, but actually the responsibility to be happy, or as happy as we can be. And the reason I say that is because there's lots of evidence that happier people are better people, less likely to commit crimes, more likely to volunteer or make contributions, better members of the community, much better coworkers and certainly infinitely better bosses and parents. So if you want to be good at the most important tasks in your life, making yourself happy is actually an important component of that. Now, that doesn't mean make yourself happy at the cost of someone else's happiness. That doesn't mean abandon all the responsibilities you may have to your work or to your family or to your community. But it does mean that one of those very important responsibilities is your own happiness, too.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great note to end this on. The book is full of wisdom about caring for your career. Because if we don't take this self-care, we are literally abandoning ourselves, aren't we? We're just reacting to somebody else's, or we're marching to somebody else's drum, basically.
We are, and not only that, but I don't, you know, the world was not made by people who were marching to someone else's drum.
Very true.
We need to get people marching to other people's drums, perhaps, to help create the world. But if you're not following your own path, if you're not finding your own fulfillment, you will be so much less good at your job, so much less good at your life.
Yeah.
It is worth the effort to make the best life and career that you can.
Absolutely. And the book is called Career Self-Care, Find Your Happiness, Success, and Fulfillment at Work. I know people can find out much more about you, Minda, at your website, MindaZetlin.com, MindaZetlin.com. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Like I say, my tagline often is make yourself happy. The thought I'd like to leave people with is this. Start small. It doesn't take a lot. You know, I know it sounds probably from our conversation like I'm advocating making big changes, and I think for some people that's probably true. But I think the most effective way to make big changes or any kind of changes is one little small step, like the 10-minute walk, like the one-sentence journal, like one tiny thing to show up as yourself at work. Just one small thing. Pick one small thing.
I love
that.
Do
it tomorrow.
I love that, Minda. I love it. And the book is, you know, I love that you've also included stories in the book about real people and real situations. And then there are some exercises to help us think things through. So, Minda Zetlin, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.